Welcome to Life List, a birding podcast.
Hello, hello. Welcome, welcome, everybody. We are Life List, a birding podcast. I am George Armstead here with both my co-hosts, Molly Brown and Alvaro Jaramillo. Guys, what's going on?
Hello.
Hey, everybody. A lot going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
It's I think we're all feeling that.
Yeah.
It's a rushing time. Maybe not for you, George. You're in the slowdown time.
Yeah. It's more mellow for me. I feel like, you know, Alvaro just got back. Molly's taken off. Like, you guys have been on the road a lot, have a lot going on. But, yeah, it's just been like kind of springtime here. I've been getting out in the garden. I've been digging that. That's been cool. Mm-hmm. But I got my first Eastern Phoebe of the year yesterday, and tree swallows are back. I've been seeing them around, but they're like really in numbers now. So there's like spring is starting to spring.
Now, isn't it close to you where tree swallows winter? Isn't that right in the Philly area, or is that?
It depends on the winter. We have famously the northern roughwing swallow population that overwinters at this one.
Oh, yes, that's right.
At this one wastewater treatment plant, which is completely random and the only real sort of viable winter population for like hundreds of miles around here. I guess there's like maybe a few that are in Connecticut some winters. I don't know if that's still happening up there. But tree swallows, like usually kind of Cape May, you know, there can be some in winter. It just kind of depends how severe a winter it is. But they, you know, like those wax myrtle, they can eat those wax myrtle fruits, unlike a lot of other birds. So they kind of hug the coast a lot, unless it's real mild. Hmm. So.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Christmas birds. You heard of that? Or we talked about that before?
That Christmas birds?
Like Belize and sort of that latitude. The tree swallows, they kind of show up around Christmas and they don't hang out for very long. And then they start heading back up north. So they call them Christmas birds and they come in big flocks. So it's really obvious.
Huh? Yeah. That's news to me. The Christmas tree swallow is a Christmas bird. I like that though. It's really like the swallows. Was it San Capistrano though?
Yeah. Yeah.
They Christmas keep to a calendar more or less. Yeah. Rather than cliff.
Yeah. And Capistrano, you know, they can't, The swallows are coming back earlier and earlier. So the whole, you know, used to come back on a certain date. That whole thing doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. Funny how climate change can change all of that.
Yeah. Can change historical and documented patterns. Huh.
Hey guys, I wanted to give a shout out real quick. A shout out to Life List Notebooks. Now, this is not related to our podcast, but these are pretty cool field notebooks. They sent one for each of us. I need to get these out to you guys, but they're really handsome, helpful, handy little, field notebooks. Good for making notes, sketches, what have you. It's got like a little, you know, some little information pages. Yeah, exactly.
I'm seeing that.
Yeah, I like that Blackburnian.
Yeah, and it's got sort of this helpful bird topography bit in the back. So lifelistnotebooks.com, not related to the podcast, but cool field notebooks should anybody want. Maybe a good gift for the other birders in your life. So wanted to give that shout out. Nice to get those here.
All right. Question for y'all. Do you use notebooks much in the field or elsewhere?
Alvaro does. I don't know if he still does, but he used to be. I was shocked and amazed to see some of his field notebooks of our first couple tours. I was like, man, this guy, he knows what he's doing.
I carry a notebook in my backpack all the time. I haven't used it as much in recent past, you know, but I think it's a good thing to do. You know, I don't do a lot of birding by myself, but I used to especially use them when I was birding by myself and make little sketches or notes or reminders or, you know, often when I use them now, I'm writing down bird bands, you know, when I see a bird band, but I do have one. And when I, but like George says, I used to be like a huge into field notes, and I feel like field notes are the key to really, really learning birds quickly. Like, that's how I did it as a kid.
Yeah, the ABA for their Young Birder of the Year program, if to be considered for Young Birder of the Year, that was one of the categories, was field notebook.
Field notebook, yeah.
Yeah, which were, it was pretty amazing to see what these kids do with the field notebooks. It's like, it's between the sketches, the notes, everything. You keep one, Molly?
Not consistently. And I use notebooks. Like I write things out a good bit for all sorts of other reasons, but I don't take them. Well, I take them. I don't use them as reliably like when I'm traveling or where I'm somewhere that's kind of newer. I use them more when I am like at home and kind of taking my time and going through my patch or something like that.
So my field notebook use is usually, you know, for like logistics notes, like there's a good restroom at, you know, this spot. And at that spot, you know, we also had really good views of, you know, a pair of spectacled tyrants, or I don't know, you know, or
what is a good restroom like? I mean, just, you know, how do you rate your restrooms? I want to know your coding, you know, like, is it Michelin 3-star? Like, this is like awesome restroom, or is it like just, it's got water, you know, it's fine, you know?
I feel like you hear in the business people say, it's got good restrooms. Like, you hear other guys say that, and it's like, it's like, okay, wow, they got good restrooms there. And whereas it's like, if someone's like, and there are restrooms there too, you know, then it's like, it's like, okay, then like you can make do, but not ideal.
You know, in Japan, what's weird is you have the most amazing toilets in the world being, you know, used throughout the country. Yet every so often,
that's big talk right there.
You know, you'll, you know, the Totos, you know, and then you go to a restroom in some random place and they'll have a, One with a toilet and one with one of those old school, like hole in the ground kind of squat toilets. And you're like, wow, like, so they have like, but they're trying to keep the historical and also have the high tech toilets all in the same place. I mean, it's
and they
it's
talk weird. To you there, right? Don't the toilets like talk to you and stuff?
Some of them do. Yeah. Yeah. And they, and they have,
they ever like sing to you, or
some of them have like dryers, music. I had one that where you open the door to the to your hotel bathroom and the toilet just opened up and it lit up and it went like, you know, it just lit up like ready for you, master. So, I felt very important when the toilet would, you know, just open up for me. It's like random. Yeah,
these sound like better than some hotels I've stayed at in some places. It sounds pretty nice.
I know. There was a little park in the middle of nowhere. You know, you couldn't even get the bus. The little road was so tiny, but there was like a restroom and it had heated seats, you know, like you're like, what the, you know, crazy. You know, I was told I didn't need to use that part of but the lady said, did you see that heated seats? You know, so it's very exciting. Talk about that's good toilets. You know, that's good birding.
Wow.
Yeah.
The toilets are really, that could be a subject of a podcast episode unto itself. Although, like critters you find in the toilet sometimes, or thereabouts, or just the state itself, probably best left undiscussed, some aspects, but, anyway, perhaps we should move on from all the toilet talk.
We should do a toilet. I have more toilet stories. So one day,
I feel like almost every trip eventually you get to that conversation about like interesting toilets and birds and animals you might see around them, or just memorable experiences. But I think we can save that for a live and in person thing, and maybe not not record that now, or people can reach out to you, Al. They can reach out to you and have a one-on-one discussion with you on that.
Just start a side podcast. It's toilet series.
I always think in Train Spotting, like, they have that scene. It's like worst, worst toilet in England. It's like that scene.
In Scotland, like would be, right? No? Is it Train Spotting with
Scotland, yeah. I guess. Yeah, yeah. This is true.
Sorry, just, you know, geographically
real stickler.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough.
I mean, because the accents. So, updates. What have we been up to?
Molly, you just got back from the UP, yeah?
Yeah, I just ran up to the UP for 4 days and got back last night. So just a quick trip. But went up and met with Corey, who is recurring on a lot of our podcast episodes. but he lives in Michigan, and we just made a plan to go up and do some exploring. I hadn't been to the UP before, and it was super, super fun. Completely lived up to all the hype that I had in my head for being up in that area. Just super vast, uninhabited stretches of public land, really cool access. What I didn't really wrap my head around before running up is that it's still very much winter up there. So it's like 65 degrees here right now. I've got the door open and everything, but there was, I don't know, 6 inches of snow, a little bit more. And temperatures were in the single digits, but we camped. And I'm not, I've realized recently, I'm not a very experienced camper. I didn't camp as a kid or anything besides like sleeping out in the cow pasture. I don't really know what I'm doing. Corey does. So that helped because I really wasn't sure if it was possible to camp in single digits. But that was, it worked out just fine. It felt like it. Kind of felt cool. They're super small towns up that way anyway. And most of them don't really have accommodations that are open year round. So we didn't have options to be around the spots that we wanted to check out. Which we kind of just centered around getting a little tour of the eastern part of the UP and went to Sharp-Tailed Grouse Lek, which was the first lek that I'd ever been to at all. So that was really fun.
That's awesome. Supposedly, really I've never actually seen those birds lekking. I've seen lots and lots of sharp-tailed grouse, but never to lek. And supposedly that's one of the best, most dramatic species at the lek itself.
Yeah. Well, this was the morning that was super cold and there was a lot of fresh snow. So we went out and there was also really thick fog, actually. It was just crazy morning. But there were just dozens in the trees eating and being really active in the sites that were known for a lot of the lekking where there's some habitat management for it. And we drove around for a few hours and eventually found eight. Maybe I'll share a link to the trip report for this because I put some video up and such. It was really cool. And just us and the birds. That was really awesome too. Yeah, that was just great. A lot of finch diversity. We had really good numbers of finches the whole time. Bohemian waxwings, which I'd only seen once before. We had couple hundred in a flock. And that was really, really cool. And they were just right along the road. So just one of those weekends of just driving and picking roads and exploring. We also did a very thorough trip report. Almost every single bird that we passed the entire time went on eBird checklist.
So it's kind of bleak up there too, right? It's kind of bleak. Like there's not that many birds, but what you do see is really cool. What all the birds that are there. Yeah.
Let's see.
Northern trikes?
Yeah. Singing northern trike.
Oh, yeah.
We had a few on territory and singing. So it was really, really cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Make some funky sounds.
Yeah. They wouldn't actually be on territory, but they start singing early. Like they sing like before they migrate. I remember, you know, and especially warm, like sunny days. I remember this is about the time of year and they started singing and they sound like a little Tweety bird, right? Like they don't, you know, you think they'd have like a big tough song, you know, like,
I'm a trike,
but it's more like
beep, 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 beep.
It's really, you know, I would love to hear that again. I remember that.
It was really cool.
I heard one
here once in Bucks County, and it was like a warm January day, and that's how we found it. It was sitting up I don't know if it was actually, if you would call it singing, but it was calling, you know, and it was doing this sort of like burp, beep, burp, beep, beep, burp, burp, you know. Like,
yeah, but so soft and high. Yeah. And yeah, really cool.
That's great. That's a good topic for one day. What birds have a voice that doesn't match the bird? You know, like, that's one of them. I think to me too, dippers. Dippers. They don't.
Mm. Yeah.
You think they'd be sort of like something, I don't know, deep and gurgly or something, but yet they sound like a thrush, a beautiful thrush, you know, kind of.
I remember that trip you and I did, Al, to Oregon. I remember at one point we heard this thing singing and we were like, what is that? And then we were like, oh, it's a dipper.
It's a dipper. Yeah.
That was exactly how the first strike that we heard was.
They make such cool sounds. Cool. Were they, what were they doing, the shrikes? Were they just teed up singing? Did you see them on the hunt much? Or?
Yeah, we only saw, I guess we only saw two. No, we only saw one and heard a second. So the one that we saw was sitting low in shrubbery, along kind of in like a thicket, wet opening sort of thing that was actually more in central Michigan and was just kind of hanging out, preening, singing, wasn't moving around much. It was right at sunset actually last night. Nice. Yeah, it was great.
Here, another question for you. I don't know if you experienced the same thing with the waxwing, but if you've been like your whole life, you've seen cedar waxwings and then you see Bohemian, I think you expect you're going to be blown away by the colors, but I'm always like, that thing is huge. Like, it looks like it's just so big. Like, it's like broad shouldered, you know?
It looked like a flock of starlings in the top of the tree when we like first went by.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. They were actually making a lot of noises too, which is really cool to hear. Oh. Yeah.
I don't even know what they sound like, I guess.
Also very, you know, waxwingly sound.
Yeah, sort of the pretty, they've got that kind of, it's almost like a rattle that they do. I've actually seen them exclusively on the breeding grounds. So I've never seen one of those like big flocks like you're describing. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, it's one of those things. I'd have to actually look at the hotspot map to know, but the hotspot in this town, they were seen at like the Dafter post office. So we didn't have a lot of details besides that to kind of show up and drive the roads. And it's just a few streets of a couple houses and you kind of drive around feeling weird and wondering what you're supposed to be looking for. And all of a sudden there's a flock. And there they were. I know there had been pine grosbeaks hanging out with them some too, although we didn't have them mixed in with that flock or in the same trees this time. But yeah, it was great. Another highlight. We heard wolves while we were out. Wow. And yeah, and that was my first time hearing wolves as well. There was one calling. It was a spot where it was actually one of those things where Corey said he'd heard them in this particular spot that we stopped at the last time he was up there a few months ago. And it, you know, I don't know. Sometimes you think that and you have that one particular spot in your mind and then you never have it repeat itself. But this time we were just walking through the woods and one started up and then we heard at least a few more. Wow. And I love that. I love when you have that consistency. It's so cool.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. It was a really fun kind of whirlwind trip and kind of felt like a nice way to close out winter actually, because now I want to find I'm hoping I hear blue-headed vireo or something while we're recording now. So.
This is getting to be time for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Any day now. Yeah. So
did you drive up there, Molly?
I did. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
How long did it take you?
Well, I drove from here to Corey's place in Midland, which is 7 hours. Not too far past like, you know, Toledo, biggest week area, Detroit, all that. And then it was another 3 hours or so from there to get up to the UP. So, yeah.
That's actually not as bad as I would have guessed.
No, it's really not.
Yeah.
As you all know, I jump in the car and drive a lot. So yeah, it's true. It was a lot better than driving through the night to get to Florida a few weeks ago.
Wow. Yeah. For the least bitter.
The last time I decided to take off for a weekend and go to another part of the country by car.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I my drive story, which is kind of totally different place. I just did a trip to Chile, Argentina, the Birds and Wine. And this trip, you know, one day we could do one of those like really crummy things that just happened on a trip. And I can tell you about crossing the Andes, you know, where we got stuck. And but let's put it this way. This trip has had different iterations where we used to drive over the big pass between Santiago and Mendoza. Then we flew because we didn't want to deal with it. And now, down in the south part of the tour, you know, we just started using this new route that crosses the Andes in a much lower place and in a place that has almost no truck traffic. And it was amazing. Like, I'd never been to this crossing between the two countries. And it was just insanely beautiful, you know, and I was thinking, like, why haven't we done this before? You know, and why doesn't everybody do this kind of thing? And I realized that the pass is it's sort of relatively new and it's being paved and, you know, really good roads. And it's one of those roads that most of the vehicles you saw were motorcycles because the whole, you know, motorcycle people have realized this is like the most awesome road to go because there's almost no traffic and curves and mountains and stuff, you know, so all the motorcycle clubs go and do it. And it was so cool. You know, we saw some good birds crossing too, you know, really nice torrent ducks and condors and all that stuff. But I was just so happy that in a trip that we've done like so long, we can still sometimes come up with a change that is like, wow, this is a great change to this trip. You know, nothing's ever static in tours. And I this was one of those times when I was like, good one, you know?
Nice. What elevation is that pass?
Oh, not very much. Like, I mean, I think it gets up to 2,000 something meters. So, you know, yeah, it's like 7,000 feet. You know, you're not getting headaches or anything up top. But
nice.
There are some high mountain birds up there, ground tyrants and seed snipe and all that as you cross. So, yeah, it's
awesome.
Pretty nice. Yeah.
One of the most beautiful parts of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Good trip, you know. So we're going to keep on doing that for the future until something new comes along.
Nice.
Do you start and stop at the same place for that trip?
We start in Santiago now and end in Mendoza on the other side. We used to sort of end in Santiago, but we realized that you can end in Mendoza and then take, you know, your flights directly from there back to Santiago or to Buenos Aires to get to the north. It gives you more options and it also, you know, keeps us from adding another day or night or whatever to the trip.
Yeah. What wines do you, like, obviously in the Mendoza area, it's going to be a lot of Torontes and Malbecs, right?
Well, Malbec, but Torontes is from Salta, but we do get it there. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what about on the Chilean side? What wines are you emphasizing there?
I mean, the Chilean wine is more diverse in a sense than the Argentinian, you know, but Carmenere is sort of the flagship. And yeah. Cabernet Sauvignon and Chardonnay Sauvignon Blanc on the coast. And now
is Carmenere the one where the fruit was thought like those grape variety of grape were thought extinct they were thought extinct for like a century or more
and then they were refound in Chile and they're gone from their original French, you know, appellation or whatever you call it or place where they're for, you know, from the Bordeaux area. So yeah,
but they brought them back from Chile, right? They brought them back from. Aren't there Carmenere grapes they brought back from Chile to that part of France or no?
No, because there's that phylloxera disease that keeps them from. And I think the Chileans haven't allowed any to leave because they know they got the market.
But, gotcha.
Yeah, but actually Malbecs are in Chile too. So there's Chilean Malbecs. And
those are two of my favorites, the Carmenere's and the Malbecs. Yeah. Both are two really, really nice.
Yeah. No, it's a lot of wine, a lot of food, a lot of, you know, grilled stuff on the Argentine side and seafood and some Peruvian food on the Chilean side, you know, so it's a lot of, so it goes. Sort of
Peruvian cuisine is, I think, underappreciated by most Americans.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And it's hugely popular in Chile because Chilean food is good, but it's not as exotic as Peruvian cuisine. And, you know, because there's been a lot of people have gone to Peru and or Peruvian immigrants and just brought the food. So it's almost like Mexican food is in the US. It's Peruvian food in Chile. It's like, it's not really, you know, it's become almost like part of the, what people eat. Like it's at the cusp of being like Peruvian food, you know, the Chileans eat it as much as the Peruvians, you know, so it's on the cusp, which is, yeah, great food. I actually have never eaten Peruvian food in Peru, so I got to go do that one day.
Mm-hmm. Add it to the list.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I feel like I don't have much to report here relative to you guys have been zipping around. I've been home. I've been kind of buried in Hillstar stuff. Like I said, getting back into the gardening. I did want to follow up because a couple of our listeners asked, and I went again yesterday to see part two of Dune. Which I must say, Al, you were saying that's something I'd watch on an airplane. That, I think, would be a mistake, good sir. Big screen, highly recommended. Quite the cinematic experience. I really loved it. I rank it as my new favorite sci-fi film of all time. And I saw it made headlines as well as, like, I think before it had even actually premiered, it had replaced the Shawshank Redemption as with, like, the highest rating ever on IMDb. I think it was IMDb. It came and it may have maintained that perch. I don't know, but it was, you know, extremely well received. And I think for good reason. So highly recommended.
No, you know, I'll disagree with you. I want to see that on an airplane.
Here we go.
Because I don't often go to see movies in the theater. And if I'm going to go to the theater, see a movie, I'm going to see a real sappy movie. So nobody can see me cry. You know, because I'd be in the dark.
I'll
save this, you know, for that time.
I think this is like the second recording in the last month where Al has mentioned that he would retire to another room so that people wouldn't see him cry.
I have an image out there in the world as a man crier, so.
Keep the facade up. What I watch on planes are horror movies that are like two rows over because I can't watch horror at all, but I can watch it like on a tiny screen that's far away
and, right,
like, glance over without sound, and then I can kind of handle them and see the gist of it.
This is funny. I actually wanted to raise that the idea of horror films as, because I
really
had, yeah, for years. In fact, I was talking about this with Phil Sean, who we're going to interview a little later. And maybe we'll save it for there, but I recently saw Hereditary, which I rank as is quite a good horror film. If anyone has not seen, which is, I think, the same director as, who did Midsommar, which is also probably a movie you'll only see once if you see it at all. Maybe we'll save the film's buff stuff for when we're with Phil.
Cool.
But Al, you look like you got something.
Yeah. Have you guys heard about this Pearly Eyed Thrasher?
No.
No, in Florida?
I don't think so.
Barely.
No. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it's in the Key West area, I want to say. You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but yeah, it was a pearly-eyed thrasher showed up at a botanical gardens a couple of days ago, and people been seeing it.
Huh.
And you know what was weird? I was like, I was thinking, you know, Puerto Rico southwards where I've seen them, but I had no idea that there were pearly-eyed thrashers all the way up into the Bahamas, like really close to Florida.
So you think it made it? You think they could make it?
Yeah, I think so, because there's even talk of like that they colonize little islets here and there, you know, in the Caribbean on their own. So, you know, it's like, wow.
It's supposed to be a big problem. Aren't they a real problem for the Puerto Rican parrots and some of the other birds there that they spoil nests a lot, I think, right? Eggs and young.
If somebody hasn't seen what a pearly-eyed thrasher looks like, go and Google it, and you'll see that gleaming, evil, pale eye and that huge bill, and you're going to be like, oh, yeah, that bird.
They do look like they have something.
Something
going on between those pearl, those white eyes that look like that's a little sinister.
I know. They're totally different from, you know, the much cuter looking, you know, scaly breasted thrashers from further down south.
Or brown thrashers. You know, brown thrashers. Yeah. Great bird.
One of the things, you know, these things are called thrashers and they're in that family, but they're actually the Caribbean thrashers are more closely related to catbirds, believe it or not, not to the real thrashers. Or our thrashers, northern thrashers. So it's a funny group, though. I thought that was pretty cool. Like, I kind of got excited that over this bird.
Such a different looking bird, too, than anything else we have around here.
Yeah. I mean, the yellow-headed caracara, it didn't kind of give me a thrill. I was like, oh. But this one.
So where does pearly-eyed fall relative to, like, the tremblers?
They're in that same group. The catbird clade. So
gotcha.
Yeah, tremblers and the white-breasted thrashers and all the Caribbean thrashers are, and then our thrashers are more allied to the mockingbirds. So the sort of two major branches in that group, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah,
that's pretty cool. That would be a very fun bird to. I didn't know about that. And that would be a very fun bird to all of a sudden be like, what the heck is this thing that's here, you know, out of nowhere?
Right. Right. You would just be like, what's that thrush? That doesn't look like a thrush. What is that thing? You know, I could see. It's just an impressive bird, too. It's just like, whoa. And I don't know if it's singing, but they're loud to have a major song when they get going.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. There you go. I'm sure there's other rare birds that have been out. Oh, well, you heard about the white-tailed eagle that showed up I was away.
I was going to say, you weren't home for that, right? Yeah. Aaron, your neighbor, Aaron Maislish, was like, he was here. We got dinner. And he was talking about how much he loves living in that area. And the next day he texted me, he was like, this is why I love living and birding in this area.
Yeah.
He's like, I was like, oh my God,
eagle.
Is some craziness.
I don't know. I mean, you guys see a lot of eagles out in the east and stuff, and we don't have as many over here on the west. So one of the things that struck me is like this eagle wintered probably in California. I doubt it went into Mexico. Maybe I think it stayed in California. It probably wintered and nobody saw it. Like nobody saw it till it moved north. I'm like, huh.
You think that's definitely, I guess in my mind, I was thinking, I wonder if that thing was like knocking around in remote BC someplace and then, you know, for some reason headed south.
But
who knows? Yeah.
I'm not sure we have that kind of thing that goes on with bald eagles much because we don't, you know, we sort of, bald eagles are, seems like they're kind of resident with a few moving north and south, you know, in the spring and fall, but not much migration. So I don't know. I mean, with an eagle, I mean, all you need to do is look at that Stellar's and it knocked around all over the place before it found a place it liked. So
raptors in general at this point just seems like pretty much anything's possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even Gundlach's a hawk on the roof in Miami,
causing trouble there. Some people shaking their fists. I'm gonna, at me now.
Molly, you, speaking of Gundlach's hawk, are soon headed for an area that is much better for them than Miami, typically.
Typically, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, just a couple days.
Wow.
To Cuba. That's wild. Watch Molly bring back a photo of a Gundlach's hawk on a roof, and we'd be like, oh,
Molly, you have to do this.
It's like a good target.
Yeah, I was like, oh, you know.
Molly, if you can
one
do this,
way or another, that yeah. photo should come back with me.
Exactly. Dear you committee, would make many people really happy.
I will never have shitty opinions again. Dear committee, I will refrain from awful opinions in the future. Dear committee, yeah. you know, like 100 yeah. times.
You're going to be like Bart Simpson with the chalkboard yeah. and like the repeating it over and over again.
That'd be like, oh, you know, and then slap myself. I don't know. Behavior, though, you know, sometimes behavior is just telling, and it just it doesn't. When if it doesn't
here,
seem
here
right,
he goes Molly.
You know,
here
he I know.
Molly's line like, him up and let him go.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. She's gonna get that photo. I know.
So Al, let me ask you this: what do you think when Molly steps off the plane there in Havana? What is going to be the first bird she is likely to see, and then what do you think will be the bird that perhaps surprises her and her group the most as being sort of really more different than one would expect?
It's well, she'll step off in Camagüey, so further to the east,
oh, okay.
right? So it's a small little airport. You know, probably the first thing would be like a turkey vulture flying over.
That's what I was thinking.
But
there's like grackles.
But yeah. I guess one of the cool things about turkey vultures, you know, that it's Cathartes aura, right? That's actually the local name in Cuba, aura. So somehow that name seems to have been transferred to the scientific name of the vulture.
Wow.
So it may be where the original name of a scientific name of the vulture comes from. So that's kind of cool, I guess, as a connection.
Mm-hmm.
First sort of, you know, bird that is unique to the area. I mean, it could be something like, well, you know, Great Antillean grackle, maybe something like that, you know, things like mm-hmm. that. The bird that maybe, you know, assuming they see it and all that, that sort of, because it's hard, but there, that I think a lot of people go, I didn't expect that, is Zapata wren. I think Zapata wren is sort of like, oh, it's sort of like a huge, you know, house wren in a marsh that sings like an overdone marsh, you know, it's like a... a mix of a marsh wren and a house wren, but big. And
it's Firminia yeah. is the genus.
Yeah. yeah.
I see that we have a big chunk of time dedicated to looking for that bird, too.
Yeah.
Multiple modes of transportation lined
yeah.
up. And I'm excited to
yeah.
see how that plays out.
Firminia cerveri, which is actually the guy who discovered it. Fermin Cervera. So he has his first name and his last name in a bird name. That may be the only place in the world, only bird in the world that has a first and last name of a person in the scientific name. Other people would know in our sphere of birder folks that listen. So maybe if you find another one, let us know.
And that is a monotypic genus as well.
Yeah.
So the only one of its kind.
Only one. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff kind of like that in Cuba. Or Cuba and Hispaniola together, where there's birds that are just oddballs left over from times gone by, even like the Trogons, and they're very old lineages. Cuban, the owls, all these old lineages of owls, you know, the bear-legged owl, or even the Cuban pygmy owls, not very like the other pygmy owls, a little different. It's a really neat place, and, you know, and the whole cultural stuff, Molly, it's going to be cool, and the old cars, and also just seeing how people live within a situation where they have very little due to the political U.S.-Cuban mm-hmm. relation. I mean, they should be our big buddies, right? They're right next door, but they're not, and they've been kind of denied through all the political stuff, and people survive, and they often survive with a smile on their face. And I just wonder, like, and they love Americans. And I'm like, wow, you know, if I was you, I'd be all bitter and like shake my fist. And I guess there has been some, you know, sort of people going out in the street recently, kind of going, you know, we've had enough. But it's an interesting place to see everything, this whole kind of worldscape, you know, of decades of politics there, you know. It's neat.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You know, when I first started preparing for this tour last year, I was thinking this. I picked up a few books while I was in Key West, actually, because there are huge sections on Cuban books and literature in all the bookstores in Key West. So first off, side question. I was in Key West the first 2 weeks of April last year, and it was hot and humid.
Yeah,
I'm guessing that's going to be pretty similar that way, although we're covering a lot of ground and changing elevations and such, but
yeah, and I think it'll be hot, but a little less humid. Maybe that Key West is, you know, being right in that water. I think it's just a little bit more humid, but it has its fair share of humidity depending on where you are, and yet sometimes it's kind of breezy, you know, so it's nice, and you know, you just get enough of a breeze that you're okay. It's a great time of year, though, because it's breeding time. So things are singing and stuff's a little easier to find sometimes. And some of the migrants have arrived from the south, like the Cuban martins and stuff like that will be there.
So Nighthawks?
Yeah, they're
really maybe.
I'm hoping they're back. You know, they're always kind of like one of those things. Like sometimes you just hit it and like they're there. And other times, you know, they're not quite there yet because they are a late migrant. For some reason, and great kingbirds will be everywhere. They're absent in the middle of winter. Things like that. Yeah. The vireos, black whiskered vireos.
Well, I started to talk about the book that I read, which is my favorite history book that I've read on any topic ever. It's called Cuba and American History by Ada Ferrer. And I just downloaded the audiobook to listen through it again before I take off or maybe on the plane. Ooh. It is
show notes that fantastic. One, Molly. I might want to pick that up. Yeah.
Oh, it's so good. I read mostly nonfiction, but this reads like a novel because that's how dramatic Cuba's cultural history is. It's written so, so well and just absolutely fascinating. So I am probably more excited to experience the culture and see everything that I've read about now as much as, or maybe even more than the birds, really.
Yeah. And the music too, like it's, you just hear music all the time or, you know, having dinner and a band will set up, you know, in the restaurant and just start playing music. And you're like, this is really good. Like these people are really good, you know? And sometimes you'll chat with them And I remember one place where the woman's like, oh, yeah, I'm a professor of music at the university. And this guy's another professor at the other university. And they're like, wow. So we're getting musicians who are incredibly skilled. And they go out, play for tourists, because that actually earns them more money than being, you know, a professional musician otherwise, or even a, you know, academic. Mm-hmm. That's one of the really sad things. There's a huge amount of essentially creative and brain power in the country that is it's sort of there and it's not being harnessed to its full potential given the economics.
I have to say that one of my I'm dying to get back to Cuba. I'm really, really eager. I had 5 days there. And it was late in the fall. And I remember it rained like a lot for like 3 of those days. We really only had one birding day. It wasn't a tour. I was just with a friend of mine at the time. But I remember going to the Hotel Nacional in Havana, which is one of the famous, famous hotels. And just seeing the hotels in Havana is itself an experience because they all have such history. And I remember being at the Hotel Nacional having a mojito, which is like an extremely touristy thing to do, but it just felt very, it felt cool. And while I was there, you know, some guys came up with guitars not at us, but sort of nearby, started playing Chan Chan, which is like a song by, you know, Buena Vista Social Club that I love. And I was like, and I actually started to like tear up. I was like, this feels like they were doing like
a beautiful.
Alvaro would have had to go to another room. I just like, I toughed it out and managed to hold the tears in. But I was like,
that was a good mojito.
It just felt, it was a good mojito as well. I mean, they're famous for that, but it was one of those moments. I was like, wow, this feels like so authentic. Even though I know this is like an incredibly touristy thing, it's still like, it kind of hit me. I wasn't quite prepared for it. And I was just like, wow. Yeah. But yeah, I love that song. I love that band and that hotel I'd been like reading about for years. And I've always loved a good mojito. So it was very memorable.
You know, that hotel, I remember we used to stay there. You can't actually stay there anymore as an American. It's a long story, but we used to stay there. And I remember going out and Matt Dillon, the actor, is out there catching a taxi, and this big old 1950s black car comes over and picks him up. And I look at him, I'm like, first of all, I was like, oh, you're shorter than I expected. But B, we made eye contact, and I think I nodded. He kind of nodded.
He got is that The Rock? That guy kind of looks like The Rock. But
is that the guy who He's wrote like that article about Ladyback Gulls? But Matt Dillon. Anyway, so that was kind of like a cool moment. That big old hotel actor coming out there and whatever. It's just like, you know, everybody goes there in a sense, you know, wants to check it out, that place.
Yeah, it's sort of like a thing to do if you're being Havana for a little bit is go do that. And it's cool.
Cool. I think the tour has a full day devoted to exploring Havana too.
It'll be the historical really cool section of Havana, and it's all the old beautiful kind of places, and it's neat. It's one of the oldest cities in the New World, and we don't think of it that way. I mean, Cuba was thriving way before the U.S. was even sort of an inkling of an idea. Sort of, if you think about it, so old.
We only got a few more minutes here, guys, before we got to scoot for our next recording session. I wanted to ask you about Cuba. I would be shocked if you have, but do you know anyone that has seen Cuban solenodon?
The mammal?
It's like a sort of a big shrew-like mammal for folks that don't know. And this is like a really endangered one that was thought extinct for a long time.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that it was thought extinct. It was just hard to see. And they're in Cuba, and they're also in Hispaniola, right? So there's...
Yes.
But it's,
I know people have seen them on Hispaniola, even though they're still hard. But
the Cuban one, I know people who've gone looking for them and found them. And it's just, you have to devote your time, like several days, nights, to actually finding them. But I think you can do this now. Like
Okay.
Isn't there another species in that family that's more common in Cuba?
Not in that family, but there is the Hutia. I don't know if that's what you would have been thinking.
The Hutias are a little bit more like, they're a rodent. So it's like a big rodent, almost like a groundhog that climbs trees with long tail. And I actually have seen those. So they're much
easier. I saw one in captivity when I was in Cuba. There was like a place I went that they had one in captivity, and it was cool to see it, but it was still a little like, tough to see it that way.
I'll have to figure out who went and saw them, but it's doable.
I think it's pretty hard. I know Adam Wallane, who I just interviewed, and his interview will come out soon. I know we didn't discuss that while we recorded, but I know he's seen the one in Hispaniola, and it took some doing and was quite a story. I should have asked him about that, but anyway, I was curious. I think the Cuban one might be even harder to see, but I'm not exactly, I don't know a lot about it. It would be one to, probably the guys on the Mammal Watching Podcast have something on that animal, because they're unique to this region.
There's a boa there too. I've always wanted to see, and I worked at some point with a herpetologist there, and he's like, oh yeah, they're super easy. You just have to go to another spot where we weren't going to, he's like, oh yeah, they're all over the place over there. It's like, oh. But it'd be interesting to see this Cuban boa. There's so many neato creatures, in general, and insects and so forth that are isolated to the island. It's
those painted snails can be stunning.
Yeah.
This is like snail diversity capital of the world, isn't it?
I think so, right?
Yeah. Mostly in the East, unfortunately, like we don't get to see the massive, you know, and apparently they collect them now and sell them, which is a
That's what I heard. They're harder and harder to find because there's a lot of collectors.
But the anoles or anoles, depending on how you pronounce those, and some of the
how do you pronounce it, Al? How do you say it?
Anoles.
Do you say anole or anole?
Anoles. Yeah, the big ones, the night.
All right.
Anole and the big.
I had to put you on the spot.
Great blue, and there's one that's got like a little circles of dark and pale on the head that's pretty amazing. And then the curly tail lizards. There's all sorts of neato stuff there. I think you're gonna have fun.
And you'll probably eat some vieja ropa at some point, the national dish, which is not a particularly inviting name for a national dish. It's like old clothes is what it translates to. But it can be pretty good. I've had some where I was like, I could have skipped this. But then I've had some that were really tasty. So
I think, you know, weirdly enough, one of the things I really like there is just when they have white rice and the black beans. And you just... You kind of mix that up and you put some hot sauce on it and you have, it's just so good. You know, it's very simple.
That's exactly what I was thinking about earlier today. I just can't wait to have a lot of rice.
Some of the Caribbean lobster down there is real good too. Mm. It's a big crayfish.
Now, I'll be reporting back.
Yeah, report back and do report back this because I've always I always get really excited in many places, not just Cuba, to have like spiny lobster. And it's almost always overcooked. Like it's a little dry. And I'm like, they go this major deal to get a lobster and don't cook it right.
That would be very painful.
That would be very painful. But it's happened to me.
But enough butter can cover many sins. So,
Yeah.
All right, guys, we got to scoot.
Yeah.
We got another appointment coming up pronto. But you guys want to let any folks know about anything before we scoot?
I just say Molly is going back to Cuba, we hope, in December or next year. You know, we're going to do more Cubas. So if you can't make the one next week,
if you can,
let us know real quick.
Yeah.
But it'd be great to
Cuba in December.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. I'd encourage folks to think about Montana this summer with Josh Coville. We got a trip called Montana Backroads to the Rockies. And we're getting close to what we need to run that trip. It would be great to have a couple more folks in Josh's neck of the woods. That's a real good one. Also, folks, remember our newsletter. We got the newsletter. It's going out twice a month, once every couple weeks. News stories we think are cool, trips that we've got upcoming, and we're always looking for suggestions as well. So thanks again for listening, everybody. You guys have a good one.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.